You're listening to Save My City, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Tony Mangini.
Hi, it's Tony Mangini, and this is the Save My City podcast, and I'm really honored today to have Congressman Dan Keeley joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You know, as you know, we've been working for quite some time now at the state level, talking about how the broken municipal finance model is really negatively impacting communities. And certainly, you know, you represent Flint, which has been sort of the poster child for some of that stuff. But something we don't talk about a lot that I know you've been really big on is a national agenda around strengthening communities. I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, sure. And first of all, I appreciate you doing this because there needs to be a lot more attention to this issue. It's in our interest. It's in our national interest. It's certainly in our regional interest that we have, you know, the strongest, most productive communities, cities and towns as we can have. And the premise is right. I mean, we have a broken municipal finance system at the state level, but we also lack any really coherent agenda around cities and towns nationally, which doesn't make sense.
I agree.
You know, I mean, if we know that the future of our communities, the future of our country is dependent on a highly productive society, an innovative society, then we ought to be putting fuel into the places that create innovation. And the history of the entire world will tell us that innovation and creativity occurs where people live and work in proximity to one another. And it can't happen in the virtual world. It has to happen in places.
Well, it's funny you say that because we've talked a lot about that. There was sort of this belief that with the internet, everyone's going to run off into the mountains and do all their work. And you're seeing the exact opposite. People want to be together, and you're seeing these collections of creative people coming together. And if you don't have the places that support that, then you're a loser in that
event. It's true. And even this is a bit of a digression, but even in offices where people feel like, well, everyone can sort of telecommute and be productive, you lose the water cooler conversation. And to a certain degree, our cities and towns are our country's water coolers. This is where people talk to one another. We work together. We come up with new ideas. We bounce ideas off one another, and we create. So my goal has been, of course, to push for more rational policy that supports cities at the regional, county, state level, for sure. But to have a national agenda, because our national interest depends on it. If we're going to create and grow the economy, it's going to be dependent on cities and towns that are highly productive and fully functional. So if we have an interest in it, we ought to put some value on that and invest to create that. So over the last year and a half or so, I've been leading a series of conversations with other members of Congress, both in Washington and out around the country, to help put an agenda together, to say to ourselves, what does it take to make sure that we have the resources we need to be the most productive places we can be? And to a great extent, in the last few decades, there really hasn't even been an explicit agenda for cities. So we're trying to put that together.
Well, I agree with you. And if you've been at this long enough, and I sadly have been, you know that. I mean, we used to have, you know, federal revenue sharing, more robust grant programs. All of those things are gone.
Right.
And there's no real strategy or investment around that. And it's interesting, something you said to me, we know these things to be facts. No one disputes that. Everyone wants to live in great places, but yet we don't invest in that way, which doesn't make any sense to me. And like you say, there's a almost a national security interest in doing that, having these strong things. It approaches 90% of the GDP comes out of these urban areas.
And I think part of the problem with the discussion that I'm trying to take head on is the false assumption that communities that are struggling, and there are communities across this country and lots of them here in Michigan, that are struggling, that have had a hard time connecting to the new economy, that are so anchored to the industrial era that it's hard to connect to what's happening in the next economy. Losing population, high rates of poverty, deteriorating infrastructure. My point is this: a lot of folks assume that those conditions are the result of decisions that city leaders have made. And it's just not the case. Almost all of the struggles facing America's cities and towns are the result of factors well beyond the control of local policymakers, local decision makers. Mayors and city councils don't plan to have globalization change the nature of the economy or to have manufacturing jobs leave to go to lower wage parts of the country or parts of the world, to have transportation policy that rewards areas that are experiencing fast growth and sort of penalizes those that have obsolete infrastructure that is trying to serve an increasingly small population. We don't plan for all this. We didn't decide that these are the factors that we wanted to have in place. But there's a tendency for policymakers to say, and I'm talking about the federal level and at the state level, to essentially blame the people who live in communities that are struggling for their struggles, when their struggles are the result of factors made in boardrooms, made in Washington, even factors that have to do with the development of technology that are well beyond our control. We have to make that case, because if we're going to argue that we should provide policy and resources to these communities to rebuild them, we have to get past this idea that the folks who are leading those places are to blame for those conditions. They are not.
Well, and I completely agree with that premise. And one of the things that I try to argue is, if this was a business, because one of the things we're always challenged, right, is you got to run government like a business. Well, if this was our business, we would be have the resource. We would be investing because of the factors you just identified, right? We have changing markets. We have changing conditions. We try to figure out how to invest that. What we've done in local government is the exact opposite. We've taken away resources, right, and somehow made cheapest de facto with best. And of course we're failing. And so we created this system that is a self-perpetuating, you know, death spiral that we keep going into because we're not providing those resources. Then we look and you say, well, why aren't you doing a better, more effective job? And by the way, here's less resources to do what you did last week, you know, and we're surprised at the result. That's what makes me really want to challenge the thinking on this stuff. And what's been interesting is we've talked with some of the business leaders around the state who are willing to hear some of this. It starts to resonate with them because they think about it in the context of the world. And it's like, well, yeah, I would fail too if I didn't invest in R&D or revenue generating things like that. And that's exactly what we're doing locally.
Right. The idea that we can impose, and that's really what's happening, imposing levels of austerity that are, you know, beyond anything we would ever want to impose on our own families, that we can impose those measures of austerity on a community and then expect it somehow to lift itself out of that. You know, the product matters. If cities and towns have a hard time making sure that there are adequate police and fire services, that parks are maintained and mowed, that the streets are in decent shape, that, you know, here we are sitting in Flint, that the water system is viable, all the innovation in the world makes it really tough to attract people to those places. So we have to have a base level of sort of civil institutions and elements of a civil society that should be guaranteed to every community. And, you know, it's not as if we can't afford it. I think that's another fallacy. We spend a lot as a society on essential public services. The question is whether we're going to spend them in places that are, you know, sort of the boomtown growth areas, at the expense of the existing built environment, or are we going to be a little smarter about this and plan for a future that relies on remaking and rebuilding the existing places where we have a lot of sunk cost, where we've already have schools and water and sewer and fire stations and police stations and parks and families and businesses? Breathing life into those communities is a far smarter way for us to plan our growth than to sort of forget those places, leave them behind, and build something new somewhere else.
Well, one of the things we've talked about in the state at the state level, and this, I wouldn't be surprised if this holds true across the country, we've doubled the infrastructure in Michigan. We haven't had any people.
That's right.
So,
which means we've doubled the cost of government.
Exactly.
Without doubling the taxpayers to support it.
And we wonder why the math problem doesn't work.
Right.
And that to me is one of those fundamental things. And again, if you were going to run it like a business, no business would say, let's build a new factory across the street from the factory that's working right now and double our costs when we're not selling any more product. But that's what we're doing at the local level. And we need a different strategy. But we've incentivized saying, you know, if you go over there, I'll give you a tax break over there. I can't give you here.
Right.
We're going to reward that community with new taxes. This community loses. It's just we're moving pieces around. We're not adding anything to the equation. And so that's where I think a federal strategy comes to help, because you talk about you got to sort of have a baseline core ability to deliver those things. Use Flint as an example. Flint lacks the legal authority, the fiscal ability to solve this problem on their own. But how do you argue that you can't have good water, safe streets, right? There needs to be that core level. And I think a federal strategy could be incredibly helpful in restoring that, which does enable them, I think, because a lot of people would love to be more engaged here. They got great bones in this town. I mean, it's got a great legacy. But you got to check those first boxes first before you can get that reinvestment and get the ball rolling again. Because once that inertia is created, I think it now sustains itself. But it's got to get that ball moving first.
Right. And so I think the way I've been approaching it from the federal standpoint is that we don't own the whole problem, but we own a big enough piece of it that we ought to be aware of that. And we ought to plan for federal investment to not be counterproductive for the fortunes of our older cities and towns, particularly older industrial cities. Most of the change needs to take place with the funding model, which is almost entirely state-based. I mean, we've just got to fix this municipal finance system so that there's less volatility as communities go through the natural ebb and flow of economic cycles. We can't have such volatility that a temporary downturn becomes a slow slide into a really bad place. A temporary downturn ought to be something that a community can kind of live through and prepare for the next wave of economic activity. But with the municipal finance system that we have in place right now, that downturn means that there's an immediate loss of public services. Essential public services have to be curtailed. And that fuels the downward spiral that a community can go through. Just having a sort of a more smooth municipal funding system that allows a community to ride through it, what could be a temporary adjustment in their economic situation, could actually set the stage for the next period of growth. Right now, we almost assure that there won't be a next period of growth. Where the federal government comes in, I think, and especially now, is to make sure that we don't fuel these unsustainable development patterns. And we could do that. And we could do that in a way that doesn't seem intuitive. Obviously, we need to do something big on infrastructure in this country. And obviously, the scale of that infrastructure investment has to start with the federal government. There's just no way to get to $1 trillion, $2 trillion, $3 trillion, or $4 trillion, which is really what the number is, in federal or in investment in infrastructure without the federal government being the biggest partner. Mm-hmm. What I worry about is that absent a focus on the cities and towns that have had a hard time making the transition to the new economy, that investment could actually provide more fuel for economic dislocation, for the relocation of wealth and economic activity out of many of our older communities into those greenfield spaces, because it's more efficient in the short term. In the long term, it's way more expensive. So what I've been pushing for, and the reason I've been having these conversations around the country, is that as a part of a big national infrastructure investment initiative, we include the kind of investment that it would take to give those communities that have been left behind a reset, clear away the remnants of the past, the blight and the abandonment, assure that there is a basic level of functionality, basic public services, so that as new investment occurs, there won't be a natural tendency for private capital to follow the really high functioning places that are getting more help and avoid the places that are really struggling. Mm-hmm. And I sincerely worry, because we have a history in this country that predicts that. In a lot of ways, what happened with a really smart investment around the interstate highway system, which was a good investment, mm-hmm. made sense, made the country safer, made us more efficient, but its benefits were uneven. And what I worry about is that if we ignore the mistakes of that history, we will repeat those the next time we really go big on infrastructure.
Well, you know, too, when you talk about efficiency, one of the things I've challenged people on that point, it depends how you define what efficiency means. If it means to that single community, that new greenfield space, it might be more efficient.
Right.
If you define efficiency on a statewide level, then that's not the most efficient. Right. It's actually wasting dollars. As we talked about, we've duplicated all of our infrastructure already.
Right.
A continuance of that further exacerbates a problem. But what we allow is that analysis to be limited to that tiny little place and saying, well, look, I can do it for a dollar less than you're doing it, ignoring the fact that we're really on an aggregate basis making it worse.
We're making it worse, and we all pay.
And we all pay.
We all pay one way or the other. We pay for doing it right in a way that's far more sustainable, or we pay because we do it wrong and we just kick the bill down the road a few years or a few months sometimes. Flint is one of the best examples of that. Mm-hmm. Flint lost state revenue sharing like a lot of other communities did. And one time we had federal revenue sharing. But the way the state has taken this on, Flint lost over a decade or so about $50 million in revenue sharing. And then it was $20 million in the red. And for a fraction of that amount of money, could have made some modest improvements to its water system that would have prevented the crisis that we're now experiencing. So for the lack of, say, $50 million or even $20 or $25 million in really targeted investment in a place like Flint, we are now up to something like $500 million in state and federal support to get this community through this crisis. So it's not a question of whether or not we pay. Mm-hmm. And that's only one measure. I mean, how do you measure the lack of increased productivity that comes with a city that can innovate and create new ideas and, you know, germinate some new concept that might be the next billion-dollar idea? Or how do you measure the social cost of a community that is stuck living with 40% of its population in poverty because it doesn't have the kind of vibrancy that puts people to work? How do you measure the cost of that against the value of investment that would avoid those costs? We just don't think very often about those things. And you're right. We think about the smallest box, and we think about the economic model of that one little square foot of land, basically, and not about the all-in costs of doing it the wrong way, which, well, we're paying for right now.
And not only all those real costs like this that you described, but the other thing, gets ignored is all the actions that were taken to, quote-unquote, balance the budget here in Flint and other places as well, are completely detrimental to the revenue model that we have here, right? Their revenue generating capacity is based on value. And when you cut public safety services, you have a compromised water system, you lower the value, you've actually exacerbated the problem instead of solving the problem. And it's so counterintuitive that you just want to bang your head against the wall. But not only do we have a broken model in how we fund it, we have a broken model in how we fix it. We basically say the only thing you can do
is cut.
That's it. And I've argued that to a large degree, what happened with Flint's water system had to do with that model. Their only charge was do things cheaper, not better, cheaper. Because the argument that Detroit's costs were going up, that's why this happened. There's 150 communities in Detroit's water system. The only one that considered that action was Flint because they were under that mandate to lower cost,
right,
and only lower cost.
Right.
And they made a decision that no one else, because everyone else had the opportunity to say, we're going to consider all factors, cost being one, but reliability of service, quality of service, all those things. And those outweighed the cost, which is what any business would do.
Right.
They were deprived of that opportunity to do that. And now, as you point out, the costs are exponentially larger than they would. And we've actually made the situation worse.
Right. I think the part of the problem is that I think there's a distinction between using business-like efficiencies and approaches, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I think, in fact, government can learn a lot from highly functional businesses that succeed. But applying the same measures of success to municipal governments that we apply to for-profit businesses is a really big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we look at the balance sheet, which is really, I mean, and I don't think there's anything wrong with this. A business is in business to turn a profit and return rewards to investors who are willing to take risk. That's a good thing. That's how America becomes such an interesting and innovative place. I don't think we want to put our communities in that same position because our measures of success are different. Number one, the quality of life for the people who live in those places is the ultimate measure of success. Having a balanced balance sheet is one of the ways to ensure that you can sustainably provide that. It's not the goal. It's a tool to get to the goal. Mm-hmm. That's one distinction. The other is the risk associated with the for-profit sector is a good thing. It's what drives innovation. But there's a big difference. Communities are not businesses. Municipal corporations are formed to serve a community, but you can't dissemble that place. You know, 90% of businesses fail. That's one of the ways the system works. Mm-hmm. We reward those who do well, and those who don't go out of business. Communities don't go out of business. They're there. Mm-hmm. They're people. They are. It's a social and economic organism that the municipal government corporation is intended to serve. So you can't just sort of dissemble these places. The people are still there. We have to provide help for them.
And I would suggest there's a third difference, which is actually an inverse relationship between demand for services and ability to provide them. If you think about your most affluent communities, they have probably less demands for social services, for sure. Recreational services. You know, if I'm living in a mansion somewhere and I want to go swimming, I buy a pool. You know, if I'm living in a community where I don't have this kind of resource, I'm looking for the community to provide some of those recreational opportunities, which we all know if you don't have those, you see upticks in public safety issues and other things. So not having that connection. So when times are tough, demands go up. And that's a completely different scenario than you would ever experience in business.
This is one of the reasons. It's a really important point because it's one of the reasons that there should be a national and state interest in sustaining municipal operations, because the fact is that it actually costs more to operate public services in a community that has had population loss and has had tax base loss. An empty house, an abandoned house sitting in a neighborhood, demands more public service than an occupied house. The odds of something happening there that will require a government response are so much more significant. It will burn. It has a negative impact on the value of surrounding properties. It's more likely to be the site of crime. The point is this, and if you think about a water system, if you have a city of Flint, for example, many others have a water system built and designed for 2.5 times the number of people who are here, those fixed costs don't go away. We need to figure out a way to help communities get through the ebb and flow of economic cycles so that the cost of their failure is not just borne by the people who live there, but by everyone else. It's just smarter economics.
Absolutely. And you know, I think I'm pretty good at what I do, and I don't often get stumped with a question, but I was in another community that had some struggles, Benton Harbor. I'll never forget this. And I was asked to go there by the state to help train them in fiscal management, fiscal practices. And one of the things we talked about was setting water and sewer rates. And I walked through the legalities of that and why that's important. And I had someone look at me in the council at the time and say something to the effect of, that's great, but the people can't afford water and they have to have water. What do we do about that? And I didn't have an answer. And I couldn't agree more. That the idea that you've got a system that's supposed to sustain itself and should generate enough revenue, colliding headlong into someone who just can't afford it because the system's been allowed to degrade to the point that now these costs are so high, how do they pay that bill? Yeah. And that's where you realize these problems are so much bigger than any local government could ever solve on their own, that you got to have, you know, a bigger power, federal, state, to step in and help with these things, or you're never going to get resolution to those things.
And those are basic elements that ought, I mean, every community has its own idiosyncrasies, but every community has to have, you know, decent schools that educate kids well, water and sewer systems that are functional, roads that work, and we got to figure out a way to make sure that those basic elements are not compromised because of some change that occurs in the economy that causes a community to lose a third or half of its population over a few decades. The idea that we would essentially double down on their downward spiral by also making those places have to deal with the fact that their water is the most expensive water in the country. It means we have to have a different approach. That's where I think a strong federal role and a strong state role has to be part of the answer, because those local communities simply can't tax or increase water rates and sewer rates out of their problem. It won't work.
I couldn't agree more. So maybe in conclusion, where do you go from here with your plan and the roadshow you're doing and talking to folks?
The real plan is to build consensus around and then offer an agenda. You know, it's an overused term, but we might as well use it, a Marshall Plan for the communities that are being left behind. So that when we go big on infrastructure in this country, and let's say we spend $1 trillion over a decade mm-hmm. to rebuild water, sewer, rail, roads, bridges, IT, we need a small piece of that to be targeted and focused on cities and towns that have great opportunity. Potential is there, but it's a potential that won't be realized and in fact could be even more permanently lost if we see a lot of capital flowing to more high functioning, you know, conventionally growing areas of the country and very little going to these older places. They need a reset. So our goal is to build an agenda that helps those communities essentially catch up with the rest of the country, give them a fighting chance to compete for innovation in the new economy, and make that as a sort of precondition to us delivering our votes in Congress for an infrastructure package that is really big. So this is all about recognizing that all is not equal in this country, and that a lot of areas have concentrated struggles in poverty, and that situation is not the result of decisions made at the local level. There was a federal role in creating that situation. There was a state role. And if that's the case, then we ought to have a federal and state role in solving it. And that's what we're really pushing for.
And that makes so much sense. And it's hard to argue with the idea that if all places were stronger, that we're not stronger as a nation rather than the strong and the weak and the battle that goes between. So I really appreciate the insights in this. This has been a wonderful conversation. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.